It happened. I heard his whole story about who she was and his whole where she worked, and how she had come down to the floor where he met him, and then what they did going out of the building, and how he helped her. He told me a lot about her and he reflected a lot about how he behaved with her and how she was feeling very much like giving up, and she was a very religious woman, and so they recited some psalms, I think, together, and he was very light-hearted with her. He tried to keep her somewhat, I guess, calm, and his way of doing that was to sort of make a few jokes and act very familiar with her and nice, and they hit it off. They bonded pretty quickly. I mean, ironically, they never really exchanged phone numbers the entire time or names, full names. I mean, it was really bizarre because she looked for him, I guess she probably told you, for months and months and months to try to find him.
I knew he worked for Morgan Stanley. And, you know, I was very good friends with one of the IT personnel that's really good on the computer. And she got on the computer, and I knew his name was Liam, and we started looking up employees, and I had other people, everyone knew I was trying to find, as I called him, and still do, my angel. So several people were trying to find him, and Morgan Stanley, this man. And somebody called my IT person, because we were on, by then we were on Penn Plaza. So somebody, one of my coworkers helped me get his number. And it started from there.
He gets a call from her at the office, and it's a voice message from her, and she's very emotional. She's had to go through this story. She's an extremely emotional woman with every Williams she could get on the phone for months and goes into tears each time. And he hears this voicemail, and he calls me right away, and he says, Susie, she's found me, because he didn't know how to find her either, and I can't call her back now. I'm working. I'm on the trading floor. This isn't going to work out. You know, you got to call her for me. Tell her I'll call her tonight. Mm-hmm. So I called her back, and she had me in tears for an hour on the phone, wailing about everything and how much she loved. She kept telling me how much he loves you, me, you know, and
it was 7 o'clock,
which is going to be the Great Exodus, and so I went down to
very good friends with one of the IT personnel that's really good on the computer, and she got on the computer, and I knew his name was Liam, and we started.
Liam Carroll's heroism, courage, compassion, and dignity were later recognized by the Episcopal Church when the right Bishop Mark Sis awarded him with the Bishop's Cross. Susan Gray has had some medical issues and left New York City to live in North Carolina. Special thanks.
She said, I love you, and I said, I love you. your inviting glance. My wife knows something's wrong. Are you alright is what she asks. Baby, I don't know what's going on. There's something wrong. The building shook. Now the emergency lights are on. And I hear a scream from something she sees on TV. She didn't want to tell me. It's another plane. A million things running through my brain. I gotta maintain, gotta stay sane. Then I heard my wife again say, I love you. And I said,
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes. Wednesday, 9:12:01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place.
On Sunday, September 11th, as part of WBAI's special anniversary programming, the next hour, with guest host Jim Freund, will feature this award-winning story, followed by an interview with Rick Bowes and the preeminent psychologist on contemporary terrorism, Dr. Charles B. Strozier. That's September 11th at 11 a.m. on the next hour, featuring Richard Bowes reading There's a Hole in the City.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. 10 years after the tragedy of 9/11, Pacifica Radio will present a national broadcast featuring special programming from each Pacifica radio station and the archives that examines its impact on American society. We invite you, the listener, to be part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Hour by including your voice along with those of Stephen Rohde, Howard Zinn, Maxine Waters, June Jordan, Bertrand Russell, Jermaine Greer, and many others. Tell us about how you heard about the attack, what you did, how you feel 10 years later, or perhaps you heard something on Pacifica Radio that was extraordinary. The subject is wide open. Call us at 1-800-735-0230. We want to hear how 9/11 changed your life or your worldview. These will be part of the commemoration broadcast on September 11, 2011. The message number again is 1-800-735-0230.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, allegedly broadcasting at 99.5 FM.
Welcome to the next hour.
A production of Cat Radio Cafe.
I'm Jenna Coleman.
And I'm David Dozer.
And you're listening to two people that are actually at this very moment in Belgium. But they are here in spirit. They are the producers of this program. And this is indeed a very special edition of The Next Hour. My name is Jim Freund. As you have been hearing on our promos, if you've been listening while we were off the air, you will have heard that we are going to have a reading of Richard Bowe's very special story, There's a Hole in the City, a fabulous piece of speculative fiction. And I am going to tell you all about Richard and Chuck Strozier, Dr. Charles B. Strozier, who will be coming in after the reading is over to discuss this. He is a fascinating gentleman as well, and we will talk about the short story. But at this time, we're going to begin that story. However, let me just thank Janet and David and the programming department at WBAI to do something as gutsy as to allow arts programming that talks about these events on such a very special day.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes. Wednesday, 9:12:01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place for my friend Mags to come up from Soho and have dinner with me. On the skyline, not 2 miles to the south, the pillars of smoke wavered slightly, but the creepily beautiful weather of September 11th still held, and the wind blew in from the northeast. In Greenwich Village, the air was crisp and clean, with just a touch of fall about it. I'd spent the last day and a half looking at pictures of burning towers. One of the frustrations of that time was that there was so little most of us could do about anything or for anyone. Downtown streets were empty of all traffic except emergency vehicles. The West and East Villages, from 14th Street to Houston, were their own separate zone. Pedestrians needed identification, proving they lived or worked there, in order to enter. The barricades consisted of blue wooden police horses and a couple of unmarked vans thrown across LaGuardia Place. Behind them were a couple of cops, a few auxiliary police, and one or two guys in civilian clothes with IDs of some kind pinned to their shirts. All of them looked tired, subdued by events. At the barricades was a small crowd, ones like me waiting for friends from neighborhoods to the south, ones without proper identification, waiting for confirmation so they could continue on into Soho. People who just wanted to be outside near other people in those days of sunshine and shock. Once in a while, each of us would look up at the columns of smoke that hung in the downtown sky, then look away again. A family approached, a middle-aged cop behind the barricades. The group consisted of a man, a woman, a little girl being led by the hand, a child being carried. All were blondish and wore shorts and casual tops. The parents seemed pleasant but serious people in their early 30s, professionals. They could have been tourists, but that day the city was empty of tourists. The man said something, and I heard the cop say loudly, "You want to go where?" "Down there," the man gestured at the columns. He indicated the children. "We want them to see." It sounded as if he couldn't imagine this appeal not working. Everyone stared at the family. "No ID, no passage," said the cop, and turned his back on them. The pleasant expressions on the parents' face faded. They looked indignant, like a maitre d' had lost their reservations. She led one kid, he carried another, as they turned west, probably headed for another checkpoint. "They wanted those little kids to see Ground Zero?" a woman who knew the cop asked. "Are they out of their minds?" "Looters," he replied. "That's my guess." He picked up his walkie-talkie to call the checkpoints ahead of them. Mags appeared just then, looking a bit frayed. When you've known someone for as long as I've known her, the tendency is not to see the changes, to think you both look about the same as when you were kids. But kids don't have gray hair, and their bodies aren't thick the way bodies get in their late 50s. Their kisses aren't perfunctory. Their conversation doesn't include curt little nods that indicate something is understood. We walked in the middle of the streets because we could. "Couldn't sleep much last night," I said. "Because of the quiet," she said. "No planes. I kept listening for them. I haven't been sleeping anyway. I was supposed to be in housing court today, but the courts are shut until further notice. I said, notice how, with only the ones who live here allowed in, the South Village is all Italians and hippies. Like 1965, all over again. She and I had been in contact more in the past few months than we had in a while. Memories of love and indifference that we shared had made close friendship an on-and-off thing for the last 30-something years. Earlier in 2001, at the end of an affair, I'd surrendered a rent-stabilized apartment for a cash settlement and bought a tiny co-op in the South Village. Mags lived as she had for years in a run-down building on the fringes of Soho. So we saw each other again. I write, obviously, but she never read anything I published, which bothered me. On the other hand, she worked on and off for various activist leftist foundations, and I was mostly uninterested in that. Mags was in the midst of a classic New York work and housing trouble. Currently, she was on unemployment, and her landlord wanted to get her out of her apartment so he could co-op her building. The money offer he had made wasn't bad, but she wanted things to stay as they were. It struck me that what was youthful about her was that she had never settled into her life, still stood at the edge. Lots of the village restaurants weren't open. The owners couldn't or wouldn't come into the city. Angelina's on Thompson Street was, though, because Angelina lives just a couple of doors down from her place. She was busy serving tables herself, since the waiters couldn't get in from where they lived. Later, I had reason to try and remember. The place was full, but very quiet. People murmured to each other, as Mags and I did. Nobody I knew was there. In the background, Rasvigi's ancient airs and dances played. Like the Blitz, someone said. Never the same again, said a person at another table. There isn't even any place to volunteer to help, a third person said. I don't drink anymore, but Mags, as I remember, had a carafe of wine. Phone service had been spotty, but we had managed to exchange bits of what we had seen. Mrs. Pirelli, I said, the Italian lady upstairs from me. I told you she had a heart attack watching the smoke and flames on television. Her son worked in the World Trade Center, and she was sure he had burned to death. Getting an ambulance wasn't possible yesterday morning, but the guys at the little fire barn around the corner were there waiting to be called, I guess. They took her to St. Vincent's in the chief's car. Right about then, her son came up the street, his pinstripe suit with a hole burned on the shoulder, soot on his face, wild-eyed, but alive. Today they say she's doing fine. I waited, spearing clams, twirling linguine. Mags had a deeper and darker story to tell, a dip into the subconscious. Before I'd known her and afterwards, Mags had a few rough brushes with mental disturbance. Back in college, where we first met, I envied her that, wished I had something as dramatic to talk about. I've been thinking about what happened last night. She'd already told me some of this. The downstairs bell rang, which scared me. But with phone service being bad, it could have been a friend, someone who needed to talk. I looked out the window. The street was empty, dead, like I'd never seen it. Nothing but papers blowing down the street. You know how, every time you see a scrap of paper now, you think it's from the Trade Center? For a minute, I thought I saw something move. But when I looked again, there was nothing. I didn't ring the buzzer, but it seemed someone upstairs did, because I heard this noise, a rustling in the hall. When I went to the door and lifted the spy hole, this figure stood there on the landing, looking around like she was lost. She wore a dress, long and torn, and a blouse, what I realized was a shirt waist, turn-of-the-century clothes. When she turned towards my door, I saw her face. It was bloody, smashed like she had taken a big jump or fall. I gasped, and then she was gone.
And you woke up?
No. I tried to call you, but the phones were all screwed up. She had fallen, but not from 100 stories. Anyway, she wasn't from here and now. Mags had emptied the carafe. I remember that she just had ordered a salad and didn't eat that, but Angelina brought a fresh carafe. I told Mags about the family at the barricades. There's a hole in the city, said Mags. That night, after we had parted, I lay in bed watching but not seeing some old movie on TV. Avoiding any channel with any kind of news. And the buzzer sounded. I jumped up and went to view the screen. On the empty streets downstairs, a man, wild-eyed, disheveled, glared directly into the camera. Phone service was not reliable. cops were not in evidence in the neighborhood right then. I froze and didn't buzz him in. But, as in Mag's building, someone else did. I bolted my door, watched at the spy hole, listened to the footsteps, slow and uncertain. When he came into sight on the second-floor landing, he looked around and said in a hoarse voice, "Hello, sorry, but I can't find my mom's front door key." Only then did I unlock the door, open it, and ask her exhausted son how Mrs. Pirelli was doing. "Fine," he said, "getting great treatment. St. Vincent was geared up for thousands of casualties. Instead," he shrugged, "anyway, she thanks all of you. Me too." In fact, I hadn't done much. We said good night, and he shuffled on upstairs to where he was crashing in his mother's place. Thursday, 9:13. By September of 2001, I had worked an information desk in the university library for almost 30 years. I live right around the corner from Washington Square, and just before 10 a.m. on Thursday, I went out for work. The Muslim-run souvlaki stand across the street was still closed. Its owner and workers gone since Tuesday morning. All the little falafel shops in the South Village were shut and dark. On my way to work, I saw a three-legged rat running not too quickly down the middle of McDougal Street. I decided not to think about portents and symbolism. The big TV set up in the library atrium was still showing the towers falling again and again, but now they also showed workers digging in the flaming wreckage at Ground Zero. Like the day before, I was the only one in my department who had made it in. The librarians lived too far away. Even Marco, the student assistant, wasn't around. Marco lived in a dorm downtown right near the World Trade Center. Then had been evacuated with nothing more than a few books and the clothes they were wearing. Tuesday had been very upset. I'd given him Kleenex, made him take deep breaths, got him to call his mother back in California. I'd even walked him over to the gym where the university was putting up the displaced students. Thursday morning, all of the computer stations around the information desk were occupied. Students sat furiously typing email and devouring incoming messages, but the intensity had slackened since 9/11. The girls no longer sniffed and dabbed at tears as they read. The boys didn't jump up and come back from the restrooms red-eyed and saying they had allergies. I said good morning and sat down. The kids hadn't spoken much to me in the last few days, had no questions to ask, but all of them from time to time would turn and look to make sure I was still there. If I got up to leave the desk, they'd ask when I was coming back. Some of the back windows had a downtown view. The pillar of smoke wavered. The wind was changing. The phone rang. Reception had improved. Most calls went through. When I answered, a voice, tight and tense, blurted out, "Jenny Levine was who I saw. She was 19 years old in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory burned. She lived in my building with her family 90 years ago. Her spirit found its way home, but the inside of my building has changed so much that she didn't recognize it." "Hi, Mags," I said. "Want to come up here and have lunch?" A couple of hours later, we were in a small dining hall normally used by faculty on the west side of the square. The university, with food on hand and not enough people to eat it, had thrown opens at cafeterias and dining halls to anybody with a university identification. We could even bring a friend if we cared to. Now that I looked, Mags had tension lines around her eyes, and hair could have used some tending. But we were all of us a little ragged in those days of sun and horror. People kept glancing downtown, even if they were inside and not near a window. The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, French avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and closed that subject. Afterwards, she and I stood on Washington Place before the university building that had once housed the sweatshop called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At the end of the block, a long convoy of olive green army trucks rolled silently down Broadway. Mag said, "On the afternoon of March 25, 1911, 146 young women burned to death on this site. Fire broke out in a pile of rags. The door to the roof was locked. The fire ladders couldn't reach the eighth floor. The girls burned." Her voice tightened as she said, "They jumped and were smashed on the sidewalk. Many of them, most of them, lived right around here, in the renovated tenements we live in now.
It's like those planes blew a hole in the city, and Jenny Levine returned through it. Easy, honey. The university has grief counseling available. I think I'm going. You want me to see if I can get you in? It sounded idiotic even as I said it. We had walked back to the library. There are others, she said. Kids all blackened and bloated and wearing old-fashioned clothes. I woke up early this morning and couldn't go back to sleep. I got up and walked around here and over in the East Village. Jesus, I said. Jeffrey has come back, too. I know it. Mags, don't. This was something we hadn't talked about in a long time. Once there were three, and Jeffrey was the third. He was younger than either of us by a couple of years, at a time of life when that still seemed a major difference. We called him Lord Jeff because he said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs. The three of us were all so young, just out of school and in the city. Then jealousy and the hard realities of addiction began to tear us apart. Each had to find his or her own survival. Mags and I made it. As it turned out, Jeff wasn't built for the long haul. He was 21. We were all just kids, ignorant and reckless. As I made excuses in my mind, Mags gripped my arm. He'll want to find us, she said. Chilled, I watched her walk away and wondered how long she had been coming apart and why I hadn't noticed. Back at work, Marco waited for me. He was part Filipino, bit of a little wise-ass who dressed in downtown black. But that was the week before. Today he was a woebegone refugee in oversized flip-flops, a magenta sweatshirt, and gym shorts, all of which had been made for someone bigger and more buff. How's it going? It sucks. My stuff is all downtown where I don't know if I can ever get it. They have these crates in the gym, toothbrushes, bras, Bic razors, but never what you need. Everything from boxer shorts on out, and nothing is ever the right size. I gave my clothes in to be cleaned, and they didn't bring them back. Now I look like a clown. They have all of us sleeping on cots in the basketball courts. I lay there all last night staring up at the ceiling with 100 other guys. Some of them snore. One was yelling in his sleep. I don't want to take a shower with a bunch of guys staring at me. He told me all this while not looking my way, but I understood what he was asking. I expected this was going to be a pain, but given that I couldn't seem to do much for Mags, I thought maybe it would be a distraction to do what I could for someone else. Want to take a shower at my place? Crash on my couch? Could I, please? So I took a break, brought him around the corner to my apartment, put sheets on the daybed. He was in the shower when I went back to work. That evening when I got home, he woke up. When I went out to take a walk, he tagged along. We stood at the police barricades at Houston Street and 6th Avenue and watched the traffic coming up from the World Trade Center site. An ambulance with one side smashed, and a squad car with its roof crushed were hauled up 6th Avenue on the back of a huge flatbed truck. NYPD buses were full of guys returning from Ground Zero, hollow-eyed, filthy. Crowds of Greenwich Villages gathered on the sidewalks, clapped and cheered, yelled, "We love our firemen. We love our cops." The firehouse on 6th Avenue had taken a lot of casualties when the tower fell. The place was locked and empty. We looked at the flowers and the wreaths on the doors, the signs with faces of the firefighters who hadn't returned, and the messages to the brave men of these companies who gave their lives defending us. The plume of smoke downtown rolled in the twilight, buffeted about by shifting winds. The breeze brought with it for the first time the acrid smoke that would be with us for weeks afterwards. Officials said it was the stench of burning concrete. I believed, as did everyone else, that part of what we breathed was the ashes of the ones who had burned to death that Tuesday. It started to drizzle. Marco stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned, with lots of stores and restaurants still closed. The ones that were open were mostly empty at 9 in the evening. If I buy you a six-pack, you promise to drink all of it? He indicated he would. At home, Marco asked to use the phone. He called people he knew on campus looking for a spare dorm room and spoke in whispers to a girl named Eloise. In between calls, he worked the computer. I played a little Lady Day, some Ray Charles, a bit of Haydn, stared at the TV screen. The president had pulled out of his funk and was coming to New York the next day. In the next room, the phone rang. "No, my name's Marco," I heard him say. "He's letting me stay here."
I knew who it was before he came in and whispered. She asked if I was Lord Jeff. "Hi, Mags," I said. She was calling from somewhere, with walkie-talkies and sirens in the background. "Those kids I saw in Astor Place," she said, her voice clear and crazed, "the ones all burned and drowned, they were on the General Slocum when it caught fire." "The kids you saw in Astor Place all burned and drowned," I asked. Then I remembered our conversation earlier. "On June 15th, 1904, the biggest disaster in New York City history, until now, the East Village was once called Little Germany. Tens of thousands of Germans with their own meeting halls, churches, beer gardens. They had a Sunday excursion, mainly for the kids, on a steamship, the General Slocum, a floating fire trap. When it burst into flames, there were no lifeboats. The crew and the captain panicked. By the time they got to a dock, over 1,000 were dead, burned, drowned. When a hole got blown in the city, they came back looking for their homes." The connection started to dissolve into static. "Where are you, Mags?" "Ground zero. It smells like burning sulfur. Have you seen Jeffrey yet?" she shouted into her phone. "Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers, all smashed and charred, are walking around down here." At that point, sirens screamed in the background. Men were yelling. The connection faded. "Mags, give me your number. Call me back," I yelled. Then there was nothing but static, followed by a weak dial tone. I hung up and waited for the phone to ring again. After a while, I realized Marco was standing looking at me, slugging down beer. "She saw those kids? I saw them, too. Tuesday night, I was too jumpy to even lie down on the goddamn cot. I snuck out with my friend Terry. We walked around. The kids were there, in old historical clothes, covered with mud and seaweed, and their faces all black and gone. That's why I couldn't sleep last night." "You talked to the counselors?" I asked. He drained the bottle. "Yeah, but they didn't want to hear what I wanted to talk about. But with me? You're crazy, you understand." The silence outside was broken by a jet engine. We both flinched. No planes had flown over Manhattan since the ones that had smashed into the towers on Tuesday morning. Then I realized what it was. "The Air Force," I said, "making sure it's safe for Mr. Bush's visit." "Who's Mags? Who's Lord Jeff?" So I told him a bit of what had gone on in that strange, lost country, the 1960s, the naivete that led to meth and junk. I described the wonder of that unknown land, the three-way union. Our problem, I guess, was that instead of a real menage, each member was obsessed with only one of the others. "Okay," he said. "You're alive. Mags is alive. What happened to Jeff?" When things were breaking up, Jeff got caught in a drug sweep. He was being hauled downtown in the back of a police van. He cut his wrists and bled to death in the dark before anyone noticed. This did for me what speaking about the dead kids had maybe done for him. Each of us got to talk about what bothered him without having to think about what the other said. Friday, 9:14. Friday morning, two queens walked by with their little dogs as Marco and I came out the door of my building. One said, "There isn't a fresh croissant in the entire village. It's like the siege of Paris. We'll all be reduced to eating rats." I murmured, "He's getting a little ahead of the story. Maybe first he should think about having an English muffin." "Or eating his yappy dog," said Marco. At that moment, the authorities opened the East and West villages between 14th and Houston Street to outside traffic. All these people whose cars had been stranded since Tuesday began to come into the neighborhood and drive them away. Delivery trucks started to appear on the narrow streets. In the library, the huge TV screens showed the activity at Ground Zero, the preparations for the president's visit. An elevator door opened and revealed a couple of refugee kids in their surplus gym clothes, clasped in a passion clinch. The computers around my information desk were still fully occupied, but the tension level had fallen. There was even a question or two about books and databases. I tried repeatedly to call Mags. All I got was the chilling message on her answering machine. In a staccato voice, it said, "This is Mags McConnell. There's a hole in the city, and I've turned this into a center for information about the victims Jenny Levine and Jeffrey Holborn. Anyone with information concerning the whereabouts of these two young people, please speak after the beep." I left a few messages asking her to call. Then I called every half hour or so, hoping she'd pick up. I phoned mutual friends. Some were absent or unavailable. A couple were nursing grief of their own. No one had seen her recently.
That evening, in the growing dark, lights flickered in Washington Square. Candles were given out. Candles were lighted with matches and bics and wick to wick. Various priests, ministers, rabbis, and shamans led flower-bearing, candlelit congregations down the street and into the park, where they joined the gathering vigil crowd. Marco had come by with his friend Terry, a kind of elfin kid who'd also had to stay at the gym. We went to this 9/11 vigil together. People addressed the crowd, gave impromptu elegies. There were prayers and a few songs. Then, by instinct or some plan I hadn't heard about, everybody started to move out of the park and flow in groups through the streets. We paused at street lamps that bore signs with pictures of pajama-clad families in suburban rec rooms on Christmas mornings. One face would be circled in red, and there would be a message like, "This is James Bolton, husband of Susan, father of Jimmy, Anna, and Sue, last seen leaving his home in Far Rockaway at 7:30 a.m. on 9/11. This was followed by the name of the company, the floor of the Trade Center Tower where he worked, phone and fax numbers, the email address, and the words, "If you have any information about where he is, please contact us." At each sign, someone would leave a lighted candle and a tin plate. Someone else would leave flowers. The doors of the little neighborhood fire rescue station was open. The truck and the command car were gone. The place was manned by retired firefighters with faces like old Irish and Italian character actors. A big picture of a fireman who had died was hung up beside the door. He was young, maybe 30. He and his wife, or maybe his girlfriend, smiled in front of a ski lodge. The picture was framed with children's drawings of firemen and fire trucks and fires, with condolences and novena cards. As we walked and the night progressed, the crowd got stretched out. We'd see clumps of candles ahead of us on the streets. It was Great Jones Street and the Bowery that suddenly were just the three of us and no traffic to speak of. When I turned to say maybe we should go home, I saw for a moment a tall guy staggering down the street with his face purple and his eyes bulging out. Then he was gone. Either Marco or Terry whispered, "Christ, he killed himself." And none of us said anything more. At some point in the evening, I had said Terry could spend the night in my apartment. He couldn't take his eyes off Marco, though Marco seemed not to notice. On our way home, way east on Bleecker Street, outside a bar that had been old even when I hung out there as a kid, I saw the poster. It was like a dozen others I'd seen that night, except it was in old-time black and white and showed three kids with lots of hair and bad attitude, Mags and Jeffrey and me. Jeff's face was circled, and under it was written, "This is Jeffrey Holborn. If you have seen him since Tuesday, 9/11, please contact." And Mags had left her name and numbers. Even in the photo, I looked towards Jeffrey, who looked towards Mags, who looked towards me. I stared for just a moment before going on, but I knew that Marco had noticed. Saturday, 9:15. My tiny apartment was a crowded mess Saturday morning. Every towel I owned was wet. Every glass and mug was dirty. It smelled like a zoo. There were pizza crusts in the sink and a bag of beer cans at the front door. The night before, none of us had talked about ghosts. Marco and Terry had seriously discussed whether they would be drafted or would enlist. The idea of them in the army did not make me feel any safer. Saturday is a work day for me. Getting ready, I reminded myself that this would soon be over. The university had found all the refugee kids' dorm rooms on campus. Then the bell rang, and a young lady with a nose ring and bright red ringlets of hair appeared. Eloise was another refugee, though a much better organized one. She had brought bagels and my guest's laundry. Marcus seemed delighted to see her. That morning, all the restaurants and bars, the tattoo shops and massage parlors were opening up. Even the Arab falafel shop owners had risked insults and death threats to ride the subway in from Queens and open their doors for business. At the library, the huge screens in the lobby were being taken down. A couple of students were borrowing books. One or two even had in-depth reference questions for me. When I finally worked up the courage to call Mags, all I got was the same message as before. Marco appeared, dressed in his own clothes and clearly feeling better. He hugged me. "You were great to take me in. It helped me even more," I told him. He paused, then asked, "That was you in the poster last night, wasn't it? You and Mags and Jeffrey." The kid was a bit uncanny. When I nodded, he said, "Thanks for talking about that." I was in a hurry when I went off duty Saturday evening. A friend had called, invited me to an impromptu survivors' party. In the days of the French Revolution, the Terror, that's what they called the soirees, at which people danced and drank all night, then went out at dawn to see which of their names were on the list of those to be guillotined. On 6th Avenue, a bakery that had very special cupcakes with devastating frosting was opening again. The avenue was clogged with honking, creeping traffic. A huge chunk of Lower Manhattan had been declared open that afternoon, and people were able to get the cars that had been stranded down there. The bakery was across the street from a Catholic church, and that afternoon in that place, a wedding was being held. As I came out with my cupcakes, the bride and groom, not real young, not very glamorous, but obviously happy, came out the door and posed on the steps for pictures. Traffic was at a standstill. People beeped. Here comes the bride, leaned out their windows, applauded and cheered, all of us relieved to find this ordinary, normal thing taking place. Then I saw her on the other side of 6th Avenue. Mags was tramping along, staring straight ahead, a poster with a black and white photo hanging from a string around her neck. The crowd in front of the church parted for her. Mourners were sacred at that moment. I yelled her name and started to cross the street, but the tie-up had eased. Traffic started to flow. I tried to keep pace with her on my side of the street. I wanted to invite her to the party. The hosts knew her from way back, but the sidewalks on both sides were crowded. When I did get across 6th, she was gone. Aftermath. That night, I came home from the party and found the place completely cleaned up, with a thank-you note on the fridge, signed by all three kids, and I felt relieved, but also lost. The survivor party was on the Lower East Side. On my way back, I had gone by the East Village, walked up to 10th Street between B and C. People were out and about, bars were doing business, but there was still almost no vehicle traffic, and the block was very quiet. The building where we three had lived in increasing squalor and tension 35 years before was refinished, gentrified. I stood across the street looking. Maybe I willed his appearance. Jeff was there, in the corner of my eye, his face dead white, staring up, unblinking, at the light in what had been our windows. I turned towards him, and he disappeared. I looked aside, and he was there again, so lost and alone, the arms of his jacket soaked in blood. And I remembered us sitting around with the syringes and all of us making a pledge in blood to stick together as long as we lived, to which Jeff added, and even after. And I remembered how I had looked at him staring at Mags and knew she was looking at me, three sides of a triangle. The next day, Sunday, I went down to Mags' building, wanting very badly to talk to her. I rang the bell again and again. There was no response. I rang Super's apartment. She was a neighborhood lady, a lesbian around my age. I asked her about Mags. She disappeared. Last time anyone saw her was Sunday, 9-9. People in the building checked to make sure everyone was okay. No sign of her. I put a tape across her keyhole Wednesday. It's still there. I saw her just yesterday. Yeah? She looked skeptical. Well, there's a World Trade Center list of potentially missing persons, and her name's on it. You need to talk to them. This sounded to me like the landlord trying to get rid of her. For the next week, I called Mags a couple of times a day. At some point, the answering machine stopped coming on. I checked her building regularly. No sign of her. I asked Angelina if she remembered the two of us having dinner at her place on Wednesday 9-12. I was too busy staying busy so I wouldn't scream. I remember you, and I guess you were with somebody. But no, honey, I don't remember. Then I asked Marco if he remembered the phone call, and he did, but was much too involved by then with Terry and Eloise to be really interested. Around that time, I saw the couple who had wanted to take their kids down to Ground Zero. They were walking up 6th Avenue, the kids cranky and tired, the parents looking disappointed, like the amusement park turned out to be a ripoff. Life closed in around me. A short story collection of mine was being published at that very inopportune moment, and I needed to do some publicity work. I began seeing an old lover who'd come back to New York as a consultant for a company that had lost its offices and a big chunk of its staff when the North Tower fell. Mrs. Pirelli did not come home from the hospital, but went to live with her son in Connecticut. I made it a point to go by each of the Arab shops and listen to the owners say how awful they felt about what had happened and smile when they showed me pictures of their kids in Yankee caps and shirts. It was the next weekend that I saw Mags again. The university had gotten permission for the students to go back to the downtown dorms and get their stuff out. Marco, Terry, and Eloise came by the library and asked me to go with them, so I volunteered. Around noon on Sunday, 9/23, a couple of dozen kids and I piled into a university bus driven by Roger, a Jamaican guy who has worked for the university for as long as I have. The day before 9/11, these kids didn't much want old farts keeping them company, Roger had said to me. Then they all wanted their daddy. He led a convoy of jitneys and vans down the FDR Drive, then through quiet Sunday streets, then past trucks and construction vehicles. We stopped at a police checkpoint. Cop looked inside and waved us through. At the dorm, another cop told the kids they had an hour to get what they could and get out. "Be ready to leave at a moment's notice if I tell you to," he said. Roger and I, as the senior members, stayed with the vehicles. The air was filthy. Our eyes watered. A few hundred feet up the street, a cloud of smoke still hovered over the ruins of the World Trade Center. Piles of rubble smoldered. Between the pit and us was a line of fire trucks and police cars with cherry tops flashing. Behind us, the kids hurried out of the dorm carrying boxes. I made them write the names on the boxes and noted in which van the boxes got stowed. I was surprised, touched even, the number of stuffed animals that were being rescued. "Over the years, we've done some weird things to earn our pensions," I said to Roger. "Like volunteering to come to the gates of hell?" As he said that, flame sprouted from the rubble. Police and firefighters shouted and began to fall back. A fire department chemical tanker turned around, and the crew began unwinding hoses. Among the uniforms, I saw a civilian, a middle-aged woman in a sweater and jeans, carrying a sign. Mags walked toward the flames. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to shout, "Stop her!" Then I realized that none of the cops and firefighters seemed aware of her, even as she walked right past them. As she did, I saw another figure, thin, pale, in the suede jacket and bell-bottom pants. He held out his bloody hands, and together they walked through the smoke and flames into the hole in the city. "Was that them?" Marco had been standing beside me. I turned to him. Terry was back by the bus, watching Marco's every move. Eloise was gazing at Terry. "Be smarter than we were," I said, and Marco said, "Sure," with all the confidence in the world.
You've been listening to There's a Hole in the City, copyrighted by the author, Richard Bose, who was the reader as well. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. The program is The Next Hour. My name is Jim Freund, filling in for the French couple who are at the moment in Belgium. That would be Janet Coleman and David Dozer. And with me are the author of There's a Hole in the City, Richard Bose, and also, if you were listening to The Next Hour last week, Dr. Charles B. Strozier. And Rick Bose has published 5 novels, 2 collections of short fiction, and over 50 stories. His work has won 2 World Fantasy Awards and the Lambda Award. He has just finished his latest novel, Dust Devil, My Life in Speculative Fiction. This story, by the way, was written and published online in Ellen Datlow's Sci-Fiction was a website run by the Sci-Fi Channel, where Ellen Datlow did one of the most remarkable jobs in the world. And, of course, the year that it was nominated for so many awards, it got killed. And Rick has lived most of his life in Manhattan. Many of his recent stories take place downtown and in Greenwich Village and the East Village of his youth. His website is located at rickbowes.com, R-I-C-K-B-O-W-E-S. Dr. Charles B. Strozier is a professor at history at John Jay and at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He's also a practicing psychoanalyst and a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Training and Research Institute for Self-Psychology, or TRISP, in New York. Much of his work is focused on apocalyptic violence and related issues of terrorism, including his current study, just published in August by Columbia University, entitled Until the Fire Stopped Burning, 9/11 and New York City and the World, in the Words and Experiences of Survivors and Witnesses. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so, and you're both on mic. Excellent. Rick, I continue to marvel at that story.
Well, actually, I do also. It sort of came out of nowhere, and so long after the event, I mean, it's 3.5 years after the 9/11 that it was published, and a lot of the material were anecdotes that I had been, you know, telling people, what was it like, you know, in Manhattan at 9/11, and I would tell them these stories. And then, because I needed to get a story written, I used this material, and the response was incredible. It was 2005, and at that point, apparently we were far enough from the event that all manner of fiction and music concerning 9/11 began to be published. I guess it took that long for it to become encompassed.
Chuck, why does this resonate?
Well, you know, it's really an interesting story because it combines the just listening to you is fascinating. I didn't realize that it came out of sort of basically interviews and anecdotes you had gathered. It has the immediacy of first-person testimony, and you feel as though reading it or listening to it that you're listening to somebody who was actually there. And within that immediacy that brings you back into 9/11 and the events of that day and the week or two afterwards, you then suddenly slip into this very exotic, almost science fiction tale, and the hole in the city that, of course, is a giant hole we all felt at the time. And I also like the way you weave in the triangle, the factory fire and the General Slocum, you know, so that these historical events that are so relevant for understanding the what occurred on 9/11 becomes a part of this story that's sort of first person testimony, history, and evocative fiction that draws us into the possibility of imagining this giant hole and death and afterlife and all kinds of associations that I had.
Well, the basic skeleton of the story is what I actually did during those days, and then around that I wove various fantasy tropes. But what I describe is what I was doing, waiting at the barricades for a friend to come up to see me, working at the NYU library. I was one of the only ones who could actually get in there to do it. I was very fortunate in that I had something to do. I think it was part of the helplessness that everyone felt was that there was nothing they could do. I did have something I could do. I could sit there, and the kids wanted somebody sitting there, somebody who was old and obviously not that easy to kill. You know, this gave them a certain amount of confidence. So it was easy also.
Yes, there are a number of references to the fact that you felt useful being older than the younger people for the first time.
Yes, it wasn't normally something that they treasured, but in this, for a brief time, yes, that it was something. It was an advantage.
I felt some at John Jay College, where, you know, we lost 68 alumni, and it's a college where firefighters and firemen get their higher degrees, and I had former students who died. And, you know, I think the same sort of thing. I created a terrorism center, and we had seminars, and I felt my sort of age and experience dealing with college students, many of whom were not only had the experience of their friends and colleagues die on 9/11, but then were working on the pile. So, you know, it was a continuing experience of living and reliving 9/11. And, you know, sort of age, people you were treated with more respect because you had some history to make them aware of.
It didn't last. They very soon went back to paying no attention to me at all. But for a few weeks there, I was a god.
There was a pull in the media. There was a period of time when we came on. I had a Saturday morning program in those days, and I was actually on the air, one of the first shows on the air after the collapse. We should mention we're approximately, 6-7 blocks from Ground Zero right now. broadcast out of 120 Wall Street. And outside of just taking calls and talking to people about that, in terms of doing arts, certainly any kind of comedy, certainly any kind of material, it was very difficult to even approach the subject for a long, long time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I started doing my study that is the result of which is this book I just published, but I started interviewing the second week. And sometime in the 20s, sometimes within 2 to 3 weeks after 9/11, I did an interview with Janet Coleman. And I remember coming down here in the evening, and this was right outside the BAI offices at 120 Wall Street, where there was one of the staging areas for the first responders. And there were lots of Army, people in full military gear.
Army base
with
right them, outside.
Right outside, and yeah. All the first responders in the military and walking over the wires and going through security. You know, it's not exactly the sort of atmosphere in which you would think a place like BAI would be operating, but you didn't have much choice. And it was very moving, actually, to talk about my early interviews with survivors and witnesses on BAI with Janet, within 2.5 weeks after the
disaster. Well, we do like to think that we and you and the people in this room are exceptional in having the ability to think and cope with this.
Well, I think reportage was valued immediately. I mean, that was, I think there was an audience for that. I do think that fiction and the other arts, elaborations on the basic events, I think it took longer for people to be willing to listen or read that kind of material. But interviews with survivors, interviews with the responders, that kind of thing, I think that was treasured almost immediately.
Yeah. You know, there's a as you, I'm sure you know, Richard, there's a shelf of books about novels about 9/11, and I think most of them, except for the Jonathan Safran Foer, are really pretty second rate. I mean, I think Netherworld by Joseph O'Neill is sort of good, but a notch down from the Foer's book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. But it is very hard. I don't think creative people have, for the most part, with those two exceptions, have really intelligently engaged the meaning of 9/11.
Well, I felt that 9/11 books immediately were kind of like those World War II novels, that they were written because people expected that they would be written. One of the paradoxes was World War I produced classics. It produced classic poetry. It produced classic novels, All Quiet on the Western Front. World War II didn't really to that extent. It was forced. It was stuff written because it was supposed to be written. There was a lack of spontaneity about it that I think was true of a lot of the, especially the novels that were published close to the event.
Well, the only exception, you know, Norman Mailer, who graduated from Harvard in 1942, and he joined the Army. We were just talking about Mailer a minute ago. He joined the Army in order to have a war experience so he could write the great war novel, and he published at 25 years of age, he published The Naked and the Dead in 1948. And so, you know, there's been nothing even remotely like that for 9/11. And you know, it's a different event, a different we're at a different era and stuff. But I think that is the one exception to the World War II literature.
I also think that in 1948, novelists, fiction writers, were more central to people's awareness. I don't know why I looked at this, but I saw it was an ad for, I believe, rum, or it might have been cigars, I forget. But it's a man, I guess it must have been cigars because he's smoking a cigar, and his name is never given. It's Ernest Hemingway. He's well enough known as a face in 1955 that you don't have to tell people who he is. I don't think that there's a writer now, a serious writer now, of whom that could be said. I mean, Stephen King is probably recognizable, but that's only because he's appeared in movies. Fiction itself is less central. Novelists, we don't sit around waiting to find out what the novelists think about things at this point. That is a difference.
Actually, George Martin and Neil Gaiman are trying to change that with their HBO connections.
It may be that they will do that, but are we really going to wonder what it is that Neil Gaiman thinks about great public events? Novelists were expected to have something to say about the events of the time.
Yeah, this event, though, is also so difficult to encompass, and I think the only way, with the exception of those two novels I mentioned, that really the literature misses the mark because they both stay too close to it and they're too far away from it. And I think the beauty of this story is that, you know, as you say, you use some of your own experience and you use anecdotes so that you have that immediacy, and yet you build this at times sort of wildly fictional account. I mean, there's a lot of fantasy here, but there is a hole in the city. I mean, and you imagine that hole in the city in ways that people can relate to. So I think it may be the only fictional approach that is effective in trying to creatively comprehend something like 9/11.
It had to be, it had in some way to be non-realistic, because the realism of the event had been covered so thoroughly on television. We all knew what it looked like. I saw it happen from the street. I watched the towers fall down from about a block away from where I live. That we didn't need. We didn't need anyone to tell us what it looked like. We did perhaps need someone to tell us what it felt like.
Well, yeah. I mean, but again, significant American writers from Philip Roth to Don DeLillo have written novels about really bad novels. And and they join an even larger shelf of somewhat lesser-known writers who are serious writers. And they just haven't found a way of capturing what it means. And I don't know whether another 10 years is going to be required or another 50 years, but we are at a point where it's both, and the 10-year anniversary is really an interesting anniversary, because I think it's the point at which individual experience and individual trauma enters into historical memory, and there becomes something larger, so that I think there may begin to open up that space for many ways of thinking about it historically, psychologically, but also creatively.
Well,
so today's a major landmark.
Oh,
in the
absolutely.
American psyche.
Ten years away.
Terribly
yeah.
important.
Yeah.
Terribly important. And that's why they had to finish the memorial. That's why they, were spending working 24/7 for the last couple of months, because they were behind.
Finally. Yeah.
Yeah. That finally did spur them to do it.
We have about 5 minutes left, and I'm thinking if we can. If listeners want to call up, and you have to be very, very on target and very brief, pithy, in fact, you can give us a call here at WBAI at area code 212-209-2900. And headphones are required to hear the phone callers as they come in. I'm particularly interested in, talking with Chuck and Rick about the impact of this fiction itself. I have a personal, as an advocate of speculative fiction, a personal view, as Chuck said. It is, in some ways, science fiction, speculative fiction, that really helps the mind get around this in the earlier days, even if they're 2.5 years later, that made it so relevant. We may not, by the way, it's conceivable we may not be able to do calls. We were off the air just before we went on, and the reason for that probably involves phone lines. So in that case, we are certainly just going to continue. Let me thank, by the way, there are a lot of people that made this morning's show happen. Of course, Janet Coleman and David Dozer, whose program this is. Grayson Challenger, Dave Glantz, and John L. Miller, who brought us back on the air. And Tony Bates and Kathy Davis, the programming department of WBAI, and Ken Gale, our ops person. So I just wanted to get that out of the way before we actually have to go off. And I don't see calls coming in, so I'm going to assume that we do not have phone access at this time, which brings me back to 10 years ago. We had no phone access then.
Nostalgia.
Yes, of a kind that it was a fascinating time right here then, because we had two huge trucks outside the building, you may remember, Chuck, that were basically working as batteries. They were supplying this building with electricity so that eventually there would be phone service and so that we were able to broadcast. And right outside was, as you said, a first responder center. It was an army base, basically, and a steakhouse was giving free food to anybody with the proper ID as a responder. It was an extremely surreal moment.
I think that combination is worth remembering. The right outside WBAI was both a first responder base and a kind of and it was a kind of a military base. And there was a militarization of Lower Manhattan. And because it was closed off for most New Yorkers, they didn't really appreciate the military presence in Lower Manhattan. It was both I've experienced it as both terrifying and reassuring at the same time.
The phone service in the village was really kerfuffled. At one point, I picked up the phone, and this voice said, "Please get off the phone line. This is Naval Intelligence." And now it may just have been somebody—I don't know what it was. But
that famous oxymoron.
Well, I don't know what it was, but it may just have been somebody, you know, who wanted to continue his phone call. But yeah, suddenly we realized how many. Well, all of the kids who were in the National Guard were called up. I mean, they were driving huge trucks around Manhattan and having the time of their lives.
Right. No, parts of Manhattan there were tanks coming down the West Side Highway.
Yep.
I mean, and that you know it was a scene. In fact, for me, and I was all over Manhattan, most evocatively right outside BAI. It was a scene out of the movie The Siege.
Yes.
The Lawrence Wright movie in 2000, you know, and that's after the whole point of the siege is after a major terrorist attack and then the military takes over and then there's this tension between the police and the military and you know, that's what we could face. I mean, I think that's that kind of image is certainly had been in my mind in the 10th anniversary. You know, what if there's something else in the future? What will be the response?
It was war imagery in the United States, and we have not had that really for decades and decades. That was part of the power, I think, of 9/11, that it was war in this country, war in this city.
No, we felt that we were at the center of the war zone.
Yes.
You know.
Well, in fact, we were. So,
yeah, that's part of the whole of the city.
Yeah, the my immediate reaction with my partner Barbara was on the 12th. We actually just left New York. We had to go just, you know, separate ourselves from that feeling, that warlike feeling that was impending upon us. We drove maybe 100 miles out to Pennsylvania, went to a motel, and what did we find in the restaurant there? Firefighters. New York firefighters sitting around a table. Glumly, I would say. Huh. And just that idea that here we went for respite.
Well, possibly so did they.
Well, I'm sure that's exactly what it was, but it certainly had that war zone feel.
Right. One of the things that...
By the way, we only have a few seconds left.
Seconds? Well, I'll just say the firefighters came from all over the country. You know, there were tens of thousands of people working on the fire, on the pile, and including firefighters from, you know, from Illinois, from California, so it was a kind of a national firefighters presence.
Police also, there were police from little towns trying to manage New Yorkers in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, okay, we're going. Speaking of national, we are going to National Pacifica Radio in a little under 60 seconds. That will be the Pacifica Radio broadcast, 9/11's footprint on America a decade later. And then later on this evening, Max Schmid and Sydney Smith will be taking your phone calls, hopefully, to discuss this. But let me thank again Dr. Charles B. Strozier and Richard Bowes for making this show possible this morning.
Thank
you. We're going to actually record a little bit more that WBAI listeners will be able to access sometime later. Again, rickbowes.com is one place. And Chuck, where do people contact you?
I have a center at my centeronterrorism.org.
Okay, very good. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Stay tuned to Pacifica Radio and WBAI all day. This is WBAI in New York.
Hour brought to you by Democracy Now.
This is Adeline Hope Bianchi from Berkeley. I do remember hearing the news about 9/11, and I burst into tears. I'm a vet of World War II. I've been concerned about our use of our great force, and I wish we had more moral power than we do military power. Thank you.
I'm still troubled by the level of complicity that I felt existed and the refusal of the government to properly treat those rescuers and others affecting the dust created by the collapse. As a result, I've become a strong advocate for protests in this country and an activist in all the problems that we are going to beset this country. And I will continue to fight on to make this country what we know America should be. Thank you.
Well, I wasn't surprised at all. Considering the U.S. policy towards the Middle East, something was bound to happen.
The so-called story is, and the explanation surrounding 9/11 doesn't make any sense. Even a five-year-old child knows something doesn't make sense.
My first thought was not, you know, how terrible it was. It was like, well, you know, basically U.S. foreign policy had finally come back to bite us.
When 9/11 happened, when I first heard of it, I thought to myself that things will never be the same. Our rush to judgment over 9/11 created a dark, dark cloud over this country that opened wide the prophets of warring that we are now seeing and possibly bringing the empire of the U.S. to an end. That's what 9/11 represents to me.
You know, when you say this, it's not to justify it, it's to understand it and explain it so it bloody stops. That's the reason for saying it.
We go now for a live report from WBAI in New York.
This is Jose Santiago for the Pacifica Radio Network in New York. Outside the World Trade Center site in Lower Manhattan, where today people who lost loved ones 10 years ago are gathering to remember them, and where city officials hope to turn the dialogue from mourning the loss of life to celebration over what they feel they have accomplished in the reconstruction of the buildings that came down in the 9/11 attacks. Speaking earlier this week, Mayor Michael Bloomberg cited the four office towers that are slowly rising from the ashes, including one that has already reached 80 floors, and he praised the progress that's been made in completing what will become the city's largest transportation hub, accommodating 9 subway lines and 2 commuter railroads. Clearly, the city fathers want to use the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks to talk about what has been accomplished rather than what has been lost. Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
There are now more businesses operating in Lower Manhattan than there were on September 10th, 01.
But community leaders say the reconstruction has favored large businesses and at times ignored the needs of small business operators and low-income tenants. One recent report by a group called Good Jobs New York cited the hundreds of millions of dollars that went to large corporations on the promise that they would remain in Lower Manhattan and even hire more workers. Unfortunately, said the report, many corporations decided to take the money and run.
We feel those very large companies didn't deserve to have so many programs benefiting them.
Bettina Damiani, director of Good Jobs New York, names the American Stock Exchange, Dow Jones, Countrywide, and Goldman Sachs as among the companies that received more than $300 million in grants and then either moved out or generated practically no jobs at all.
Goldman Sachs got so much resources after 9/11. They've got a special lease at Battery Park City. They got tax-exempt bonds called Liberty Bonds, and they also got cold hard cash. And it seems that they are behind on the number of jobs that they're supposed to have.
In the end, says Damiani, the state retrieved only about $13 million of the $304 million given to large companies. One of the many issues that is percolating here in New York on the 10th anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks. For Pacifica's 9/11 Footprint on America, I'm Jose Santiago in New York.
This is Pacifica's 9/11's Footprint on America, 10 years later. I'm Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! It was 10 years ago today when the World Trade Center and Pentagon were attacked. At the time, Democracy Now! Was on the air, just blocks from Ground Zero. We were in our studios at a decommissioned firehouse run by Downtown Community Television in Chinatown. Just 3 minutes into the show, as I was reading the news headlines, I heard a muffled explosion outside. It was the second plane hitting the World Trade Center. Listeners soon hear sirens wailing outside the studio. Moments later, Keiko Tsuno, co-director of DCTV, burst into our studio. She told us they were opening the firehouse to help people fleeing the disaster. Ironically, we were doing a special that day on the connection between terror and September 11th, 1973, when the Pinochet forces rose to power in Chile, bombing the palace. Salvador Allende, the democratically elected leader, died in the palace that day. We then went on to a taped interview from the World Conference on Racism in Durban, South Africa. I soon cut off the interview to announce the breaking news. We stayed on the air for hours that day. Lower Manhattan would soon be declared an evacuation zone. The line was drawn at Canal Street, two blocks north of our studio. We were in the evacuation zone, along with Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan. We stayed in the firehouse for days. To start this September 11th special, we turn back to those early moments just after we learned the World Trade Center was attacked.
How do you, as a woman political activist, deal with this when it's the voice of the government that's represented at this world conference?
The voice of the government and the voice of the citizens of Canada.
I'm going to interrupt this tape conversation that we're having with two women, one from Kenya, one from the Sudan, at Sango Chisoni, just answering this question because of the latest news. Just a little while ago, actually, during this broadcast, we heard a loud explosion and we heard ambulances, or rather we heard sirens. Well, it appears that planes crashed into the upper floors of both World Trade Center towers minutes apart this morning in a horrific scene of explosions and fires that left gaping holes in the 110-story buildings. No immediate word on injuries or fatalities in the twin disasters which happened just around 9 o'clock, New York time, and President Bush has called the World Trade Center crashes an apparent terrorist attack. The FBI is investigating reports that two plane crashes at the World Trade Center are the result of foul play. A senior government official speaking on condition of anonymity said the agency is pursuing reports that one or both of the planes were hijacked and that the crashes may have been the result of a suicide mission. The source stressed the reports are preliminary and officials do not know the cause of the crashes. Now, the latest news that's coming from CNN right now in Washington, D.C., that there is a huge plume of smoke also at the Pentagon. Possibly a plane hit the Pentagon as well. And that there is a fire there, as well as a fire on the mall. And CNN is showing scenes right now of a fire behind the old executive office building. As we speak, the White House is being evacuated. The Pentagon is being evacuated. Again, the latest news that we have, and this is all unfolding as this broadcast takes place, planes have crashed into the upper floors of both World Trade Center towers minutes apart this morning, just about 9 o'clock. Brad Simpson, our producer, is right next to me. Brad, why don't, instead of you writing a note, tell us what you have also heard.
We just heard on CNN that the Federal Aviation Administration has just suspended all air traffic at all airports around the United States. Planes are not taking off. I assume they're still landing. But all air traffic around the United States has been temporarily halted by the FAA.
And you may hear in the background the sirens. We're in Chinatown. We're not far from the World Trade Center buildings. Again, we did hear the explosion just a little while ago. We're talking about two explosions in both towers of the World Trade Center where we see plumes of smoke. People are stopping everywhere. The emergency vehicles are racing down to the World Trade Center. It appears that planes crashed into these buildings. And in Washington, the news of fire at the Pentagon, on the mall, the White House being evacuated, as well as the Pentagon. All over the country now, flights have been suspended for at least 7 hours. Miranda?
Now what they're saying is that it's obviously a terrorist attack and that they're investigating into connections with Osama bin Laden.
Now, of course, in these preliminary reports, all sorts of information is put out, as you may well remember from the Oklahoma City bombing. I painfully remember talking about the suggestions of who it was when in fact it wasn't. So we are not going to draw any conclusions at this point, just reporting the information of the planes crashing into the World Trade Center buildings. The plane was coming in low. It looked like it hit the World Trade Center at a slight angle, large holes visible in the sides of the 110-story buildings, the landmark Twin Towers, side of the World Trade Center exploding, debris falling like leaflets, ambulances, emergency vehicles racing to the scene. They have been passing us as we can hear the sirens going off. Thousands of pieces of what appear to be office paper drifting over Brooklyn, which is miles away. People are seeing this paper. It does look like there has been an explosion on Capitol Hill, and that is the latest news. We'll see if Brad or Miranda can bring us in some of this information. Eyewitness reports that police saw parts of the South Tower peeling away. Thousands are watching, police frantically telling people to move away. The latest news, a plane hitting the Pentagon, the Army area of the Pentagon. They're evacuating the Pentagon, the White House, the Treasury. All planes stopped in the country. At this point, CNN is simply reporting from downtown Manhattan the frantic efforts to get people out of the World Trade Center buildings. And again, we hear that the State Department, the White House, the Pentagon, the Treasury have been evacuated in Washington. Anthony, what have you just learned?
No, it's a rather personal thing. A friend of mine works in the World Trade Center, and she actually went to a dentist appointment this morning, but she's all broken up now because, you know, as you know, most people work with other people. So this is going to have far-reaching effects, and I can't even explain it. It's just far-reaching effects personally as well as economically, just everything. The world has definitely changed.
That's right. President
Bush has said that there will be retaliation. That's for sure. He used some strong words. So prepare yourself for a changing world right now.
Thousands of people work in the World Trade Center buildings. Miranda?
Yeah, it's really unbelievable to watch the footage, which many people may be watching as well on CNN, of the second World Trade Tower, World Trade Center Tower collapsing in on itself, just literally crumbling into pieces, and the impact, the power of that impact is unbelievable. And I'm just sort of phenomenal to imagine the number of people who have been who were inside the World Trade Center because they did not manage to evacuate it.
Miranda, it looks like 50,000 people work in the World Trade Center complex. 50,000 people.
Well, I just went downstairs for a moment, and I actually ran into, in the hallway, a man whose wife was on the 101st floor of the World Trade Center where she works, and he's been trying to reach her for 2 hours, and it'll be fairly impossible to reach her, I'd imagine.
You are listening to our continuing coverage of what is a massive disaster unfolding in New York, in Washington, D.C. Eyewitness reports right now where we are in New York. I'm Amy Goodman here with Miranda Kennedy, Brad Simpson, and Anthony Sloan. We're on Lafayette Street, just south of Canal, and not far from the World Trade Center towers. It looks as if the South Tower has collapsed. The North Tower on fire. Eyewitness reports that police saw parts of the South Tower peeling away as thousands watched, the police frantically telling people to move away.
The level of panic on CNN is pretty unreal. And there's constant background of shrieks and reporters as well as sirens, and it's sort of the same scene here in New York, although we're sequestered in a small studio here. We can hear sirens all around us, and on the floors downstairs in downtown community television, there are people who are sobbing, who are terrified, who are watching out the windows nervously. This is an unbelievable scene.
It is September 11th, 2001, a day that will certainly be marked for a very long time to come. U.S. federal buildings all over Washington have been evacuated. In New York, World Trade Center down. In Pennsylvania, not clear if this is connected, but a 747 crashing near Somerset County Airport in western Pennsylvania, 80 miles south of Pittsburgh. The United Nations has been evacuated. The New York City elections today, primary day, have obviously been postponed. All traffic is being blocked from 14th Street down. Governments around the world have condemned the attack. Not at all clear who is responsible for this. No confirmed reports of anyone taking responsibility for these attacks.
Right now, the move is to try to evacuate Lower Manhattan and basically everything below Canal Street, and trying to evacuate people from Canal, from everything from the Battery all the way from South Ferry right up through Canal Street, which is a major street going across Manhattan, goes to the Holland Tunnel. So they're trying to evacuate everybody from the Battery all the way up through Canal Street.
Well, we're going to try to be here as long as possible.
Could you tell us what you saw?
Mr. Secretary, do you consider what happened today, both in New York and here, an act of war?
There is no question but that the attack against the United States of America today was a vicious, a well-coordinated, a massive attack against the United States of America. What words the lawyers will use to characterize it is for them.
Mr. Secretary, today we saw military planes both in New York and in Washington. How much more of a military presence will we see now that this incident has occurred for the next week?
Those kinds of decisions are made day to day. It is correct that we had aircraft flying protective missions at various places in the United States today, and they will do that as appropriate.
And that is Secretary of Defense or War Donald Rumsfeld speaking at the Pentagon late yesterday. We're joined on the phone by Chalmers Johnson, a leading scholar of Asia and U.S.-Asian relations. In his book Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, he writes, I believe it's past time for Americans to consider why we have created an empire, a word from which we shy away, and what the consequences of our imperial stance may be for the rest of the world and for ourselves. The byproducts of this project are likely to build up reservoirs of resentment against all Americans, tourists, students, and businessmen, as well as members of the armed forces, that can have lethal results. For any empire, including an unacknowledged one, there's a kind of balance sheet that builds up over time. Military crimes, accidents, and atrocities make up only one category on the debit side of the balance sheet that the United States has been accumulating, especially since the Cold War ended. How do you think these words that you wrote years ago in your book, Blowback, Chalmers Johnson, apply to today?
Well, that's exactly what has happened. This morning's New York Times says, a day of terror. I'd have to say it was a day of revenge, a day of blowback. It reflects the loss of hope among a great many people around the world in the face of our overwhelming power. I, like everyone else, am angry, affected with despair and helplessness over the scenes in New York City. At the same time, one has to ask, why us? What have we done? That is, this issue of, they just asked Donald Rumsfeld, should we declare war? The important issue precisely is declare war on whom and over what. I believe it is imperative that we engage in some self-reflection, that we try to restore in this country some sense of diplomacy, some sense of ourselves as a model for the rest of the world rather than simply a hegemon, that we move away from our creeping, not-so-creeping militarism. I fear that the unintended consequences of these events on September 11th will be more militarism. So that it's not, I'm not gratified to say that the book that was published just last year and was written as an intended warning to my fellow citizens and based on, I'm 70 years old, on my life as a student of international relations, I'm not at all pleased to see it come true, but I can't say that I'm surprised.
You write in your book, what we have freed ourselves of is any genuine consciousness of how we might look to others on this globe.
Yes. I received a message yesterday from a colleague in Okinawa. That's 38 American military bases on an island smaller than Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands. He said to me, we didn't do it, but we're not sorry. I'm sorry to say, an awful lot of people around the world went to bed last night not sorry that it was time the biter was bit, that the people of America now know what a bomb city looks like, have some hint of Hiroshima. After all, we were bombing Serbia from 50,000 feet only 2 years ago in pursuit of our particular foreign policy. So that the president vows to exact punishment for evil. Is it evil that we are talking about here? And if it is evil, who's evil? I believe we partake in it.
Our response involves far more than instant retaliation and isolated strikes. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen. It may include dramatic strikes visible on TV and covert operations, secret even in success. We will starve terrorists of funding, turn them one against another, drive them from place to place until there is no refuge or no rest. And we will pursue nations that provide aid or safe haven to terrorism. Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. From this day forward, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime. Our nation has been put on notice. We're not immune from attack. We will take defensive measures against terrorism to protect Americans.
That was President George W. Bush. On September 13th, 2 days after the attacks on the World Trade Center, we called up Columbia professor Manning Marable.
Well, thank you, Amy. And first, we must offer our deepest condolences and sympathies to the families of the thousands of innocent people who were killed in this tragic and horrific event. For those of us in New York City who watch New York One or the local stations on cable, you know, there is this impression, I suppose, throughout the world that people who work in Wall Street area or at the tip of Manhattan or the powerful and the affluent, the vast majority of the families I've seen, the faces I've seen on television, are black and brown, Latinos and blacks and others who work as clerical workers and custodians, mothers looking for their children, husbands looking for their wives, sons. It's been truly horrific. And I think that many, many families in New York City will feel this pain for many years to come. I think it's important as for the American progressive movement to recognize and to reject unconditionally any use of terrorism as a political weapon, whether it's committed by individuals or, more generally, by governments, because it's alien to the traditions of the democratic left and classical Marxism. You can't win the social justice movement through the use of this kind of extreme terroristic violence. This opens the door in a very ugly way to a racial subtext that I'm very fearful of. Not only racism in the sense that it gives a free hand to the use of the state to carry out in the name of civil safety, public safety, a disregard of civil liberties. And we know in a racialized state, in the context of that, the people who are going to get hurt the most are Latinos and blacks and other people of color. But what it also does is put forward a kind of ugly anti-Arabism. And you see examples of that throughout the country already, the mosques being shot at, death threats against Arab Americans, who are appalled and as shocked and outraged by this act of terror as any other American citizen. So all of those things are now unfolding. And unless the American progressive movement, the social justice movements, have an orientation around these issues that fights for civil liberties and civil rights, that opposes the subtext of racialization, then there will be a dramatic move to the right. And now is the time to speak truth to power about these things.
That was the late Manning Marable speaking on Democracy Now! 2 days after the September 11th attacks. As Democracy Now! Continued to broadcast blocks from Ground Zero, we started looking at worker safety issues. Cleanup workers expressed concern to us about their health, but federal officials, including EPA head Christine Todd Whitman, insisted the air was safe to breathe.
As I say, you know asbestos was in there, is in those buildings, lead is in those buildings. There are the VOCs. However, the concentrations are such that they don't pose a health hazard. We're going to make sure everybody's safe.
It's incomprehensible that that building came down. But, I mean, I guess it buckled and just the weight of the floors brought it down. Big, big, big building. Big building. And like I said, it's 20 feet high now. Where is that building? Downstairs, I mean, there's a lot of building that come down.
And all they're worried about is getting the market open and getting everybody back to work. And it's devastating. Half the neighborhood's still under all the asbestos and everything else.
Last night.
People, you don't know, we were walking through there yesterday, asbestos flying, and they didn't even have masks for us until today after we had a fight for them. But meanwhile, you go over here, they got everything you want. We had to go over there and get them, which was sickening. But all the asbestos, and they're saying it's not asbestos. We talked to a few people who were here. They says the count was, their counts were over 5% asbestos. And Giuliani says there's no asbestos. But that's another argument. And these firemen, the first day, had no mask, no nothing. And they Tuesday one had everything. They were just standing there. They were all white. The blue uniforms were practically white, you know? And there was all dust, breathing in this dust for hours and hours and hours, you know? And I tell you, the firemen and the cops, they deserve everything they get. Because they were there putting their lives on the line and going, it didn't matter to them. You know, it really didn't matter. Trying to save lives and just standing there in all this dust and breathing.
As far as who we're going to pay back and how we're going to pay them back, I have no doubt that there'll be some retaliation. And like I got two kids in college and I'm not interested in sending them to war at all. Stand, especially not for terrorists, but they'll be dealt with.
Asbestos.
They'll be dealt with.
There's your asbestos. In our shoes, it's bringing to our houses.
Well, Bush is coming in tomorrow.
Oh,
yeah.
I forgot, it was going to be a madhouse. The worst thing, he's the worst guy to be here tomorrow.
Why do you say that?
Why?
Because he just shut
you got enough cops
down.
And everybody around here now. You need him? You don't need him.
Well, I don't think like him. I think it's a good thing he's coming.
Oh, it's good for the politicians.
We continue to closely cover the issue of the health effects of Ground Zero workers. In 2009, on the 8th anniversary of the attacks, we interviewed Joe Picuro, a New Jersey iron worker who worked as a volunteer on the pile for 28 days.
I left for around midnight. I left my house and I watched like everybody else on the TV. I watched the towers go down, and I have policemen and firemen in my family, and I knew the kind of equipment they carried, and I knew they didn't have the kind of equipment to cut that steel. So I grabbed some of my tools, and I jumped in my car, and I went up there. And
you lived in Tom's River, New Jersey, right? That's about, 60 miles from New York?
Yeah, about 68 miles. Something like that. And I threw my tools in and I walked into hell, into surreal. I never seen anything like it. There was, it was literally tripping over body parts. It was you know, we were putting them in 5-gallon buckets for the first couple of hours I was there, and it was bad. And I stayed there 28 days. I stayed there 14 days total at first, and I came home for 8 days, and I went back for another 14 days. The first couple of days I slept on the floor of the American Express building because they didn't have anywhere else for us to sleep, and that I knew about anyway. And so I slept in the dust and the glass of the American Express building when I could. And
Joe, you started coughing the first day?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, within minutes you got down there, you started coughing. All the air was filled with dust still, and, you know, every time you moved, you kicked up dust. I mean, it was knee-deep in some spots, you know. It was pretty surreal, you know. You couldn't see what you were stepping on, what you're tripping over. It was part of the street fell in. Me and a bunch of firemen started running, and they grabbed me and said, run, and the street was falling in, and I ran, and then I realized I was running alone. They were running back, so I turned around and went back with them.
Joe, tell us your condition today. This is the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. It's actually just down the road from where we are now. We were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero in this big old 100-year-old firehouse that also our colleagues opened up for people just running down the road to give them water, to let them have access to the phone. Today, Joe, 8 years later.
Well, right now I'm hooked up to my oxygen machine. My lungs are, I went to the doctor yesterday, and it was, we didn't get good news. So basically the doctor said, you know, if he could get me another year or two, you know, he would, you know, he'd be surprised. And so I'm on 37 medications. Well, actually 39, he put me on two more, when I went to see him yesterday. And, you know, most of my problems come from my lungs, but my whole body is racked with pain. All my joints, it's just like a laundry list of problems. That, you know, if it's not one thing, it's another. You know, breathing, like I said, is the hardest. Like I said, I'm hooked up to oxygen now. My lungs have concrete and glass and human bone fragments in them. And, you know, so what happens is your lungs are the only organ that rejuvenate themselves. And mine, instead of growing viable lung tissue, they're growing, it's growing scar tissue. So it's making my lungs get bigger and bigger. And when I take a deep breath, my lungs actually rub against my ribs and it hurts.
Joe Pecoro died on October 15, 2010, just over a year after we spoke to him. He was 43 years old. And on this 10th anniversary, just Friday, we had a conversation with Anthony DePalma, who just got new documents for ProPublica detailing how the feds downplayed Ground Zero health risks. Juan Gonzalez, co-host on Democracy Now!, is the first, really, to have exposed the health conditions at the World Trade Center at the so-called pile. We're joined by two guests here in New York. Anthony DePalma, former New York Times correspondent who covered 9/11 health issues. He's also the author of City of Dust, Illness, Arrogance, and 9/11. Now, of course, Juan's co-host on Democracy Now!, but he is also the author of Fallout, The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse. Amazing, Juan. Your book came out just really months after the September 11th attacks, exposing particularly Christine Todd Whitman and what she had to say at the time.
Yes, that was in May of 2002. too. And I'd like to begin first with Anthony. The latest article that that you've come up with in ProPublica, you talk about that and the new revelations?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I want to make clear that these documents that we were able to review, because they were gotten through Freedom of Information request by the New York Committee on Occupational Safety and Health, build on a lot of the reporting that you did. So let's get that straight. I mean, you were there at the beginning, and you sort of pointed at these issues at a time when the government was saying, well, maybe we don't need to worry about it. Mm-hmm. And so you raised the flag, and Joel also getting some documents early on. What these go beyond what we already knew. We knew that there had been a certain amount of manipulation on the part of the White House, but what this shows is that they really were doing it from the very beginning, and there was a concern. You know, it's interesting that we're talking now right after you did that piece on the World Trade Center building and how costly it is and how much it's supposed to be a symbol of something that's sort of gone, the whole thing has gone awry. In many ways, what was happening back then is that they were really worried about symbolism, the symbolism of people getting back to work no matter what. And they didn't level with people. And that's the most disturbing thing. There were clear warnings, specifically on Water Street, which for those people in this area know is not far from Wall Street, that showed that the levels of contaminants in the air were too high for people to go back. That was removed, which was bad enough, and then replaced with a recommendation that people go back to work. They were urged to go back, even though the early samples were showing that there were high levels of contaminants. While the anniversary on Sunday is the 10th anniversary of a particular day and lots of people are moving on with their lives, for these people who are affected by the dust, it's the day that doesn't end.
When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, hear my cry, hear my call, hold my hand, lest I fall.
The legendary folk singer Odetta. She was performing at the Firehouse Studio on the first anniversary of the September 11th attacks.
The United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
In one of our most memorable interviews after the September 11th attacks, we interviewed Rita Lassar and Masouda Soltan together in January of 2002. Rita lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. She helped found September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Masouda Soltan is an Afghan-American who lost 19 members of her family.
As you heard about this latest bombing, Masouda, what is your response?
When I first heard yesterday, I froze. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to do. I immediately thought of what had happened to my family. I wondered what they must have gone through. I wondered I turned on the TV. I mean, it took me back to the story that my family had told me. And I did not want to think about what those people on the ground must have been going through when this was all happening. If it indeed was a wedding party, thinking of what a joyous occasion that must have been, what they must have been doing at the moment when this happened, and how tragic for this to turn out this way.
It is painful to go back to your trip to Afghanistan when you went to find your family members who survived a previous U.S. bombing. But we wanted to play an excerpt of your report as you were driving on this dusty road into Afghanistan after you had just talked to your family members, those who had survived, who had gone into a Pakistani, were now in Pakistan as refugees. This was your report to us in late December.
We went over there last night. I had heard that there was some devastation. My family, I have some cousins that live in Kandahar, and the extended family is about 55 people. They lived right near some Taliban compounds and buildings, and they anticipated that once the U.S. bombing campaign started, they wouldn't be safe any longer where they were. They decided to move out to some farmland they had about 50 miles outside of Kandahar City, and were staying there in order to stay safe. One evening at about midnight, while they were sleeping, they heard some loud noises outside and realized that their area was being bombed. Some rockets hit nearby, and they decided they had to leave their rooms. As they were running outside of their rooms, some of them were wounded by rockets. Some of them were being shot at. They described the scene where they were running with their kit in their arms, dodging bullets left and right while they saw balls of fire falling down to the earth. They had no idea what was going on, and they were just running in any which direction for their lives. Some of them hid under an area that was covered, and some of them heard word of their loved ones falling to the ground as they were
we're talking to Masuda Sultan, who's describing how her family members were killed by the U.S. bombs that fell on the farmhouse they were taking refuge in outside of Kandahar. She's speaking to us from Afghanistan.
There were some women and children running for their lives, being shot at by a helicopter hovering over their homes. And these people were not Taliban supporters. They weren't Al-Qaeda fighters. They were simple Afghans trying to stay safe in their own country. The events of September 11th really made me angry, but seeing these people and what they went through make me angry as well. You know, they say
that was Masuda Sultan speaking to us from Afghanistan as she learned what happened to her family members. Now in the studio with us as we hear about this latest bombing yesterday of a wedding party. Rita Lassar, you started speaking out publicly after your brother Abe died at the World Trade Center on September 11th. And as you were grieving, you figured out very quickly what was happening in Washington, the gearing up for war. Can you talk about your campaign from then till now and what the two of you have been doing in Washington?
Amy, I'm very frustrated. Since we got back from Afghanistan, Peaceful Tomorrows and Global Exchange have been begging our government to establish an Afghan Victims Fund. And instead, all we seem to be able to do is create more victims. And then, when our government, quote-unquote, accidentally kills more people in Afghanistan, I'm reminded of something Allen Ginsberg said about Dean Rusk during the Vietnam War when he was making one of these pious stupid statements. He said, the Secretary of State is speaking language, and we are using language, our government and our military, to obscure the fact that, like my brother, whom I loved and haven't even started really grieving, every one of the people who were killed yesterday has a sister like me, or a mother or a father. And these are real people. And our government, although it's very deferential to us because we lost family members, has no intention of establishing a victims fund or stopping establishing more victims.
Rita Lazar and Masouda Soltan meeting for the first time in our studios, January of 2002. Rita Lazar turns 80 years old this week.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
MIT professor Noam Chomsky.
Other polls ask people, why did the United States invade Iraq? Well, here it's in the United States, there's some answers, straight answers. So the official reason, widely repeated, as long as you could hang on to it, was that we invaded Iraq because of their weapons of mass destruction and their links to terror, which are just such a threat to us that we can't let it continue. And there was a massive government media propaganda campaign about this starting in September 2002 when the invasion was effectively announced. And it did drive a large part of the U.S. population completely off the international spectrum. The United States was the only country where a large part of the population was genuinely afraid of Saddam Hussein because of his weapons of mass destruction and his links to terror. And it turns out that the people who had those attitudes are strongly correlated with support for the war, which is not in the least surprising. I mean, if I believed those things, I'd support the war too. I mean, if you believe that here's a murderous tyrant accumulating weapons of mass destruction, responsible for 9/11, linked to Al-Qaeda, planning new terror, we've got to stop him in time, yeah, it's a rational decision to invade Iraq. Of course, there's not the... it was never... There never was any reason to believe that there was a particle of truth to that. And as I say, the U.S. was alone in having any detectable part of the population hold those opinions, even in places like Iran and Kuwait. The lying about that continues until the present. It doesn't matter that it was all debunked. So George Bush, in his radio addresses just a couple of weeks ago, he continues to repeat that the U.S., I'm quoting him, saved the world from a tyrant who was developing weapons of mass destruction and cultivating ties to terror. Well, you know, nobody believes that, including his speechwriters. But they know it, but they know something else. They know that if you keep repeating a lie long and loud enough and nobody takes you account for it, it'll become truth. There are plenty of precedents for that, not pretty ones to think about. But they're there, and you know them, so I won't go on with them. But it helps account for the reactions that you hear around the world. The collapse of the official stories about weapons of mass destruction and terror, they did have consequences. In fact, ominous consequences. The most significant consequence of the collapse of the story about weapons of mass destruction was that it changed the official doctrine. All of this is taking place in the context of the national security strategy that was announced in September 2002. And that strategy was based on the principle that if a country has weapons of mass destruction, the United States is entitled to attack it in anticipatory self-defense. What's called in the press and some commentary preemptive war, but that's a total fabrication, has nothing to do with preemptive war. It's just a euphemism for direct aggression.
Terry Rockefeller of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows visited Iraq twice after the U.S. invasion. Her sister Laura died on 9/11 at the World Trade Center.
When I was in Iraq just a little over a week ago now, I was attending this meeting of a two-year-old now, but really rapidly growing network of peace and nonviolence activists in Iraq. I think that the first response to our telling our stories, and I was accompanied by another Peaceful Tomorrow's member, Adele Welty, whose son was a firefighter and also died in the Trade Center, was that they found our choice of pursuing nonviolence surprising and improbable. But then I think it made a very, very deep bond. You know, literally every member of this organization had a comparable story to tell us of losing a family member. And yet they have chosen in their cities and in within their society to reach out to support dialogue rather than violence, to try to prevent the use of toy guns, which have been leading children in Iraq to be shot out by the military. They are working to build a culture of peace, and they're doing it with the deep knowledge of their own society. So I found that by the end of spending a week with them, we had built bonds of hope. And I, as a member of Peaceful Tomorrows, I will be working to see that as their week of nonviolence happens soon, we can spread more word about their achievements.
Alex Ryaboff is a Marine who served during the invasion of Iraq, co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War.
The thing is, before going to Iraq, the reasons were questionable. We even had our first sergeant come out and tell us, you know, this man's a veteran of the first Persian Gulf War, been in the Marine Corps 20 plus years, and he actually, after our commanding officer told us that, yes, we're going to Iraq, he came out to talk to us and said, in going to Iraq, don't think you're going to be heroes. Don't think you're going there to topple Saddam, find weapons of mass destruction, or make Iraq safe for democracy. He said you're going there for one reason alone, and that's oil. And this is our first sergeant telling
us. Where were you when he said that?
This was at Camp Lejeune. This was on base. And, you know, a lot of the younger guys were taken back by this because these were, you know, it's not the official reason for going to Iraq. This is not what's being plastered all over the media. But, you know, guys like myself who had been in for a while, just we knew the government was involved in underhanded things, and it seemed this time that we would be involved in one.
1 year after President Bush landed on an aircraft carrier with a huge banner reading, "Mission Accomplished." Imprisoned Iraqis are being tortured and humiliated at the hands of U.S. troops. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh about another explosive expose.
It's a total war crime. It's a crime against humanity. It's a crime against the Geneva Convention. And of course, it's also dangerous in a rational world to the presidency itself, because if you don't inflict values at the very beginning, you do end up down the road with the kind of abuses we had. And that's, I think, the story in a nutshell. Somebody who worked for Condoleezza Rice, I'm talking about people in the White House, got in touch with me and told me that, in fact, there had been a lot of concern about prisoner abuse much earlier. So what you have, if you want to talk about how Abu Ghraib began, what you have is a attitude that these people are not humans. Dehumanization, we do that more all the time. But you also have an attitude that it doesn't matter what you do.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
We're joined right now by Yanar Mohammed. She is director of the Organization of Women's Freedom, a group that works to stop atrocities against Iraqi women. One of the organization's main projects is the development of a battered women's shelter in Baghdad to protect women who are fleeing from violence and honor killings.
In Baghdad, we had our demonstration on the 4th of this month, and we said we need safe streets for women. And our recognition of why it's unsecure is because the occupation is still there, the U.S. troops, and that is attracting all sorts of terrorism from all over the world. Now, Our cities, our neighborhoods have turned into daily battlefields between the U.S. troops and the military resistance. Women cannot leave their homes for work, for studying, for even the streets have turned into unsafe places because of the inhumane practices against women by the rising Islamism. And it's not safe anymore. That's why we demanded for the immediate leaving of the U.S. troops from Iraq as a prerequisite for any change towards peace. And what we see now happening in Iraq are consecutive failures, one after the other, for the U.S. administration. They just cannot make it work. Whatever government they're bringing is totally rejected by the people, and all kinds of opposition to it, political opposition and the other kind of opposition that's military. Some of it is local, but some of it is coming from abroad. Because of their holy jihad against the Americans, we are paying the price, and Iraqis are being killed by hundreds every day. We think this needs to stop, and there's no way it can stop if the U.S. troops do not leave. Some people would say, how would you have security if there is no army to protect you? We tell them there is nothing worse than what we are facing now. Hundreds of innocent civilians being killed every day is something that we don't want to see anymore. U.S. troops have to leave now, immediately.
As we mark the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops and contractors remain in Iraq and Afghanistan. In recent months, the United States has also carried out airstrikes in Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, and Somalia. We end this hour with the words of Afghan activist Rangina Hamidi. In 2009, she told us more troops will not solve the problem.
Last night, we were at a friend's house for dinner. And I'll begin by quoting her directly. Her name was Shala, and she said, quote, "Every time someone from my household goes out, I accept in my heart that they may not come back." This is the kind of feeling and attitude that most Afghan people live with today. This is a political situation where, in my opinion, this is my personal opinion, that for every one individual we kill, and often it's easy to claim that this is a Talib. You know, we bombard a village and then say, well, we killed the Taliban. That's not necessarily true. A lot of innocent people get killed. The common people are stuck in the middle. So on the one hand, the Taliban or insurgents might come at the nighttime with guns and ammunition and force the village people to keep them, meaning give them housing, give them food. And when they do that, because they can't, you know, ordinary people cannot fight back, in the morning or maybe a day or two later, the military get reports that the Taliban or insurgents have come, and then they start bombarding. So when they bombard, the bombs are blind. They don't see who's Talib and who's not. We can't differentiate between the ordinary people and the Taliban. So a lot of innocent people are being killed in the process. And the psychological effect on people is that whether it's a Talib or you know, or an ordinary person, it's an Afghan that is being killed at the end. And so it is very hard to not feel bad for innocent people being killed. And so my assessment is that for every one person that we kill, we're creating 10 more who are against us. So if this policy of war and killing continues, I don't know if we're going to get any good result in the near future.
Rangina Hamidi speaking to us from Kandahar, Afghanistan. And that does it for this hour of Pacifica's 9/11's Footprint on America 10 years later. This edition of Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke and Sam Alkoff. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Renee Feltz, and Nathaniel Bassett. Also, thanks to all my Democracy Now! Colleagues over the years for making this broadcast possible. You can visit Democracy Now! org for a web exclusive on the 9/11 decade that showcases our vast archive of in-depth reporting. It includes an interactive timeline of our coverage in the first year after the attacks and features our reporting on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, domestic spying, the persecution of the Arab and Muslim American community, and more. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. Can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. My back's a 60-pound stone. My shoulder half mile of line. Come on up for the rising. Come on up, lay your hands in mine. Come on up for the rising. Come on up for the rising.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
This is Pacifica's 9/11's imprint on America, 10 years later. This hour brought to you by the Pacifica Radio Archives and from the Vault Radio.
That particular morning, I had a very severe stomach cramp and a very severe headache, and I could not for the reason understand why. So I woke up, I turned on the radio, and I heard Amy Goodman's voice describing that there had been an attack on the Pentagon.
Hi, I'm Lori Garrett. I'm the Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, and I'm also a writer, and I've written several books. The most recent one is called I Heard the Sirens Scream, How Americans Responded to the 9/11 and Anthrax Attacks. New York City itself is a character, and it's a character with historical strength and resilience. And indeed, I saw New Yorkers behave with a level of compassion and concern with one another that was absolutely 180 degrees the opposite of the stereotype of New York.
Hi, my name is Jean James. I'm from Mill Valley, California, and back on September 11th, 2001, my father and I, on a tour of the United Kingdom, were on a highway driving right past the small border town of Lockerbie, Scotland, when tour guide pointed out the very field wherein 1988 now convicted Libyan terrorist Al Megrahi bombed and downed Pan Am Flight 103. And all the passengers on board were hushed and had a dazed look on their faces.
My name is Parviz Sultanpour, and I'm in Larchmont, New York. I saw the events on September 11 on TV, and I was horrified. And I was worried about our daughter, which was in college. She called, and I went to pick her up. And fortunately, we were not affected in this area. We were away from downtown New York.
This is Christine Black. I'm reporting from near the World Trade Center Memorial site at St. Patrick's Chapel. We're on the corner of Broadway and Fulton. And I'm here with Nick Savoca. He's the director of Youth with a Mission at a prayer station that he's set up across from the church. Nick, first of all, tell me what brought you here today.
We're basically here because we want to extend to people the same comfort God has given us. And the best way we know how to do that is to pray for people who desire prayer.
So who are some of the people who've stopped by your station today, and what have they been telling you?
We've had a number of people stop, and people concerned about the families specifically of those that were lost, and asked if we would pray together for those families. Others who were concerned about the country and the world, and also their own families. So we've gone global. We've prayed for the city. We've also prayed for individuals and families.
So have you had people from all over the country, all over the world, all over New York?
Yes, I prayed with one man from Brazil, and we've also had some others that were from Europe that stopped and prayed with us as well.
So what is the history of this prayer station that you've set up today? You've set it up before.
Well, we started prayer station ministry in New York City in 1992. And then when the disaster happened on 9/11 in 2001, we felt like this was something that we needed to do to reach out to people. And so we started bringing the prayer stations out to the street. We had over 2,000 volunteers help us. We made a commitment to do it 6 days a week for a solid year. And during that year, we prayed with over 50,000 people on the streets here in Lower Manhattan. I feel very deeply, as do many Americans, about the significance of this day.
I was speaking with Nick Savoca. He's the director of youth with a mission here in New York City. For Pacifica 9/11, Footprint on America, I'm Christine Black.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the historic Pacifica Radio Archives, the oldest collection of public radio programming in the United States. And welcome to the second hour of this Pacifica National Simulcast. In this hour, we will focus on how we as Americans responded to 9/11 in its immediacy, in the months following, and now 10 years later. We turn to our Pacifica Radio Archives collection, an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lori Garrett, analysis by some of the most visionary thinkers of our time, Noam Chomsky, Tariq Ali, Gore Vidal, and Arundhati Roy, and most astounding, phone messages recorded by you, the listener, for this broadcast. Next is the first of three segments from our Voices for Peace mix, produced for the first Memorial 9/11 broadcast on Pacifica Radio in 2002. That year, grief was still palpable. War had already been waged with Afghanistan, and war in Iraq was inevitable. These voices from our historic collection are those we discovered that gave us courage and inspiration. You will hear Bertrand Russell, Barbara Ehrenreich, Stephen Rohde, Howard Zinn, Maxine Waters, Dennis Kucinich, Gore Vidal, June Jordan, Michael Moore, Angela Davis, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnam poetry of Curtis Bennett, John Trudell, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Michael Parenti, and Cornel West.
I appeal to you, citizens of America, as a person concerned with liberty and social justice. Many of you will feel that your country has served these ideals, and indeed, the United States possesses a revolutionary tradition which, in its origins, was true to the struggle for human liberty and for social equality.
Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended. Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible.
Let me set the record straight. I know that we have a problem with terrorism, and some of us, maybe foolishly, gave this president the authority to go after the terrorists. We didn't know that he too was going to go crazy with it.
The patriotism that emerged as a marketable commodity in the aftermath of the attacks, allowing the U.S. flag to adorn every imaginable aspect of daily life, did not cause the fear to wane, but rather established an array of enemies to be feared as intensely as people learn to fear the possibility of another attack.
If you are not comfortable with the war in Afghanistan, you know, to really realize we are all united, we are American, and part of that for me is being able to openly disagree with what is going on.
Large numbers of people are gathering all over the country, and they do not get in line with the president on the matter of going to war in Afghanistan.
Perpetual war for perpetual peace has been American policy since 1950.
Listen to this. Yesterday, six Viet Cong came through my village, and because of this, my village was bombed, completely destroyed. Every soul was killed. When I come back to the village now, the day after, There is nothing to see but clouds of dust and the river still flowing. In the invisible presence of all the people still alive on earth, let me raise my voice to denounce this filthy war, this murder of brothers by brothers.
I want you to know that you're not alone. I want you to know that there's millions of Americans out there who are sick and tired of what's going on. They want to come out of the house. They want to talk. They want to ask questions. They want to dissent.
I do not believe that we must kill or be killed. Do you? I do not believe that we should tolerate a military dictatorship of the press. Do you? I do not believe that we must yield to those homicidal lunatics who occupy the White House and the Pentagon. Do you? No more war. No way. No more war.
That particular morning, I had a very severe stomach cramp and a very severe headache, and I could not for the reason understand why. So I woke up, I turned on the radio, and I heard Amy Goodman's voice describing that there had been an attack on the Pentagon.
My name is Parviz Soltanpour, and I'm in Larchmont, New York. I saw the events on September 11 on TV, and I was horrified. And I was worried about our daughter, which was in college. She called, and I went to pick her up, and fortunately we were not affected in this area. We were away from downtown New York.
My name is Reva, and what I want to share with you is that after September 11th is really when I started to listen to KPFA and really started to depend on Pacifica Network and on KPFA in particular, because I was not able to rely on any of the information that I was receiving anywhere else.
Hi, I'm Lori Garrett. I'm the Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, and I'm also a writer, and I've written several books. The most recent one is called I Heard the Sirens Scream, How Americans Responded to the 9/11 and Anthrax Attacks. Having been through so many gigantic humanitarian crises, epidemics, wars, I thought I was immune to such things. How could I possibly be traumatized by something that was a single event followed by anthrax mailings? I've been through it all. This is no biggie. But what I learned was that it's quite different when it's your own home. When you're in an Ebola epidemic on the other side of the world, it's possible to turn on certain kinds of emotional switches that allow you to observe the events but not have them be felt on a kind of deep, deep level that traumatizes and hurts you for years on end. But when it's your home, the place that's supposed to be safe, the place that you love and that is surrounded by the people that you love and filled with love, then all of a sudden it's quite different. It's much harder to distance yourself. How do I distance myself when I lay down on my pillow on the night of 9/11 and wake up in the morning to see blood on the pillow and realize that I had coughed up the World Trade Center on my pillow overnight? Then it's not an emotionally distant event. When I get on a subway and the whole entire subway car is silent and no one wants to make eye contact, and someone mistakenly, innocently, lets loose with a seat flap that goes bang against the wall of the subway, and the entire car looks up, startled and terrified. People start crying because of the sound of a bang in the subway.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lori Garrett. We'll hear more from Lori later on in the program.
My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the chief announcer at WBAI in New York. I was uptown in Harlem at the time having breakfast with some friends, and around 8:45, right around that time, the word came in. Somebody ran into the restaurant and said a plane had hit one of the towers. Now, I got on the number two train, and I rode down as far as it would go. It went to 42nd Street, and it stopped. All service was discontinued at 42nd Street on that particular line, and everybody had to go out and come upstairs and start walking wherever they were going. And everybody in the city was dazed. There was no bus traffic per se. Everyone was walking. People were in cars listening to the radio. And as I got further downtown, I could see one of the buildings. It was smoldering. I'm not sure if both towers had come down at that time or what. This was about, I guess, 10 in the morning, 10 or 11 in the morning. WBAI is on the East River, and the World Trade Center actually is on the just about on the Hudson River, but it's the Manhattan Island is at its narrowest point down at this part of the Manhattan where Wall Street is. So it sounds like, you know, Hudson River is a long way, but it's not really. It's 10 blocks. And, you know, I still look back on that. And as I got down to the Brooklyn Bridge, and I was still drawn toward WBAI because I knew that's where I was supposed to be. However, everyone is walking away from downtown Brooklyn, and I'm making it to the end of Wall Street, where this incident, this horrific incident that I've found out now what it was, what actually happened, you know, that I'm walking there. And, you know, I keep thinking about, why am I doing this? I should be walking across the Brooklyn Bridge toward home where I was living at the time. But I didn't. I kept going until I got to Wall Street. I finally got to the station as my shift usually starts at 12 noon. I don't recall who the host was at the time, but the arts director, I believe it was Matthew Finch, and the news anchor, Jose Santiago, were on the air at that time.
And let's go to the music, and stay tuned for Democracy Now!, which is coming up in about 5 or 6 minutes. Oh, we have breaking news. It looks like a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. There is a huge explosion and fire at the top of the World Trade Center. This is a live broadcast at 8:52 in the morning. We have no story right now as to the cause, if it's an accident or was intentional, but it looks like the top half of both towers are absolutely in flames. This is a huge disaster. Be careful. Stay out of the lower Manhattan area. We're going to get headlines on this story and be back as soon as we can with updates. Again, live at this moment, an aircraft or something has exploded into the top floors of the World Trade Center, causing a massive disaster situation. A lot of smoke coming out of the tops of the building.
Towers.
This is live.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major disaster, and you have to understand the World Trade Center just 7 years ago was the target of a terrorist bombing attack that injured and killed 6 people and injured 1,000. And we don't know what is the nature of this, if it was just an accident or intentional, but it looks like a disaster has occurred in Lower Manhattan. This will be dominating our news throughout the whole world in the United States, I'm sure, today. And stay tuned for Democracy Now!. And I'm sorry, sad to report the disaster in Lower Manhattan. And I'm sure
I
there's
hope
a
nobody
look
was hurt seriously.
Oh, I would say it
but
looks
look
like
that.
Somebody was yeah. hurt seriously.
It's a major, major disaster
exactly.
right now.
At least the people who
be
were in
careful.
That plane
to avoid Lower
yeah,
Manhattan.
Not with us anymore.
Stay out of Lower Manhattan.
Good morning,
hello.
WBAI.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
It knocked out all the TV stations.
Right.
You know that?
All
yes.
right, thank you.
Oh,
thank you very
see.
Much
yeah,
for that.
Okay, yeah,
yeah,
all right.
We're broadcasting from the Empire State Building, which means that our broadcasting facilities are still on the air. We know many people will be tuning into WBAI to get information, and we can tell you that the World Trade Center has been hit by an airplane, a two-engine airplane. Beyond that, we know very little. A second aircraft, we don't know what kind of aircraft struck the other tower. Both towers are now smoking.
Amen. I always knew about BAI through my father. And since 9/11, that day, I realized how fake the media was. And then I started listening to BAI. And ever since then, I've been listening to BAI since 9/11. That's why I called. Okay? Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Judith Pierre. I'm calling from Oakland, California, to share that 10 years later, I'm really sad because of what the United States has done in the name of revenge. I'm sorry that we couldn't do more to stop the subsequent wars that we initiated in the name of avenging this event. And I'm also sad about the way we treated the rescue workers.
Hi, I was at the University of Baltimore in Baltimore, Maryland, where at a meeting when we got the news of the attacks. They tried to continue the meeting, but then when they realized how serious it was, they stopped the meeting. I immediately went to our provost and said, we have to be sure that no attacks occur on our Islamic students, our Muslim students, who we had a number of at the University of Baltimore.
Hi, my name is Arnold Freeman. I'm calling from Peekskill, New York. I remember I was home that day. I worked for an agency that was destroyed in the World Trade Center. I knew people that were killed and how it changed my